Before we begin, we're all deeply grieved by the events of last night, and we're all touched by this tragedy. Our thoughts are with the victims, and our gratitude is with the first responders, civilians and professionals alike, who put themselves in harm's way to assist others. At this time, we'll call case number 65062, Curtis Guy versus State of Nevada. Ms. Gomez?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Pamela Gomez on behalf of Petitioner Curtis Guy, who is facing the death penalty for killing no one. This morning, I would like to emphasize two points, that the prosecutor's misconduct and that the prosecutor's eliciting of false testimony both provides good cause and prejudice for this Court to address the underlying merits of the claims, as well as overcome procedural bars. Second, that this Court's recent decision in Richard Kennedy v. State, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Buck v. Davis, allowed this Court to reconsider its prior decision concerning the trial counsel's ineffectiveness. In this case involving a non-triggerman, the prosecutor elicited false testimony concerning the possession of the gun, who was actually used to kill Mr. Evans. Through the testimony of who was then 15-year-old Tyrone White about the caliber, the 25 caliber gun, which was the murder weapon, the prosecutor was able to prove under three different theories that Mr. Guy had actually participated in the murder. Under the theory of aiding and abetting, who owned the gun was actually used to encourage the jury to find Mr. Guy culpable as an aider and abettor. Under the theory of conspiracy, where there was no evidence of a tacit agreement, who owned the gun was used as a way to for the jury to infer that Mr. Guy had agreed on the murder. And finally, under the murder of family murder, who possessed the gun was used to infer, so the jury could infer that Mr. Guy had assisted in the murder. I would submit that where there was no special verdicts and only a general verdict, the false testimony elicited by the prosecutor from Mr. White was material in this case. We know that the testimony concerning who owned the gun was actually false because at Pendleton's trial, before Mr. Guy's trial, the prosecutor elicited from Mr. White that before anybody else, the gun belonged to Mr. Pendleton. Whereas at Mr. Guy's trial, the prosecutor elicited from Mr. White that the gun belonged to Mr. Guy.
Counsel, wasn't the testimony from the previous trial readily available to defense counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, and indeed that was actually part of ineffective assistance of counsel. Under the U.S. Supreme Court precedent in Napier v. Illinois, whether the false testimony is actually unearthed by trial counsel at the time of trial is not the test. The test is whether the prosecutor knowingly elicited false testimony. Whether or not the prosecutor gets caught is not part of the test. We know that the testimony concerning the ownership of the gun is false because Mr. White has now told us that he had no idea to whom the gun belonged, that he just told the prosecutors what they wanted to hear. We also now know that Mr. White, who also participated in the French incident, when he was first arrested, was let go on his own recognizance. It was only until he broke probation that he was actually detained. When he broke probation in early March of 1991, the prosecutor scheduled a hearing, a revocation hearing for the day of Mr. Guy's trial. The revocation hearing was postponed at defense counsel's request because Mr. White was not in the courtroom. After the conviction and sentence of Mr. Guy, then the prosecutor actually held the revocation hearing at which the prosecutor just requested further restrictions concerning his parole. For his participation in the French incident, Mr. Guy received 5 years of probation, as opposed to actually being detained for his participation in the event. We know that the prosecutor knew the testimony was false, which is the second prong of NAPUI, because in rehabilitating White's testimony at Pendleton's trial, the prosecutor actually referred to an interview White had provided to the police officer where White said, before anybody else, the gun belonged to Pendleton. Again, under NAPUI, we know that the test is whether the jury could have, whether the false evidence could have affected the jury's verdict.
But how do we know which is false? The first statement, the second statement, the middle statement, how do we attribute that to the prosecution?
Because Mr. White tells us that he had no idea who the gun belonged to. And that's actually in the Doucette Declaration, which is Exhibit 84 to our petition. So both scenarios are actually false. And we know
because his third declaration under oath is the one we should believe.
Your Honor, unfortunately, we have no subpoena power, and we have been unable to actually bring the sworn testimony of Mr. White to the court. But our burden at the lower court was to present a colorable claim of relief, not belied by the record. We have made enough of a showing to receive actually that evidentiary hearing. The second point that I would like to make is that, again, this court decision in Canape v. State, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court press decision in Buck v. Davis, allowed this court to reconsider the underlying claim of ineffectiveness assistance of counsel. In Canape, this court recognized that its prior interpretation of Supreme Court precedent, Rompilla, Wiggins, as well as Williams, as applied to Mr. Guy, had been erroneous. Mr. Guy could not be blamed for not providing the information that trial counsel, representing the defendant on a capital case, the type of investigation counsel needs to undertake. The jury that convicted Mr. Guy did not know that as early as 7 years old, he was sexually abused by his aunt, who was also his half-sister. The jury who convicted and sentenced Mr. Guy to death did not know that he himself was the product of an incest, of the rape of his mother by her stepfather, who began abusing her as early as 7 years old. The jury that convicted Mr. Guy, and sentenced him to death did not know that he had also suffered sexual abuse by his mother's boyfriend. We now know that that information should have been provided to the jury, and that information is mitigating for the jury. The test is, in assessing the trial counsel's ineffectiveness, the test is not whether the jury, after hearing it all, would have convicted and sentenced Mr. Guy. The test at penalty is whether this type of evidence might have influenced the jury, sufficient enough to undermine confidence in the act. In comparison to other cases, including U.S. Supreme Court cases, Mr. Guy's jury would have been swayed by the mitigation had trial counsel conducted a constitutionally effective investigation.
Do we judge that according to the aggravators that were legitimately in play? Two have been eliminated, and a third was the French aggravator, which is troubling because that event postdated the killing in this case, and he pleaded guilty to it shortly before this case went to penalty hearing, as I understand the chronology.
Yes, Your Honor. He actually pled guilty to that crime and was sentenced to that crime the day before trial in this case began.
And that was the third aggravator, and then the other one was under sentence of imprisonment?
Correct. And he was under parole at the time of the incident.
So do we assess, it's very hard, but do we assess then additional mitigation in the context of today's view of which aggravators were legitimately in play as opposed to those that were presented?
Yes, Your Honor, and this court may weigh under its court's jurisprudence, it may weigh the aggravators, the only two remaining aggravators, and then the evidence that was presented.
So you're asking us to look at the impact of counsel of IAC on under a contemporaneous view, which is only two aggravators were in play and one may have been contributed to by trial counsel's incompetence.
Yes, Your Honor. And in comparison to U.S. Supreme Court cases, including Rompilla, Terry Williams, as well as Wiggins, where the aggravators were also very disturbing, and in comparison to the mitigation that Mr. Guy presents and should have been presented to the jury, had trial counsel conducted the constitutionally adequate investigation, there is enough sufficient evidence here to undermine confidence in that verdict. In comparison to the other cases where the U.S. Supreme Court granted both relief because of both deficient performance and prejudice, Mr. Guy here is the non-shooter. In all those three Supreme Court precedent cases, the actual defendant was the killer. So in comparison to the aggravators as well as the underlying events, the mitigating evidence that Mr. Guy presents is more than sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome.
When in the proceedings did it come out that Pendleton had the charges dismissed? The 108 Nevada opinion, footnote 1, the initial direct appeal says Pendleton was also indicted for Evans' murder. Pursuant to a plea bargain, Pendleton was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. That statement appears from the briefing in this case probably to have been incorrect insofar as the Evans killing was concerned, but probably correct because he was sentenced on another killing to life without parole. Is that right?
It's partially right, Your Honor, because unfortunately, because of counsel's efficient performance, neither the jury nor the court ever heard that.
Right. So when did it come out that Evans, it's correct that all charges against Evans, against Pendleton associated with the Evans killing were dismissed. Is that
correct,
right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And when did that come out in Mr. Guy's case?
It actually came out in appeal when appellate counsel asked the court to enlarge the record concerning Mr. Pendleton's charges.
On the direct appeal?
On the direct appeal.
But the court's opinion doesn't note that.
Correct, because the court denied the request to enlarge the record. So the jury never heard that the actual killer, that the charges against the actual killer were dropped. We also know, going back to the NACUI violation, we also know that the ownership of the gun was important because when the charges were first presented at the Justice Court level, both the charges of felony murder under the robbery theory, as well as murder, were dismissed for probable cause. The only substantial difference between the preliminary hearing as well as trial was Mr. White's testimony concerning who owned the weapon. We also submit that the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel provides both cause and prejudice for this court not to apply the procedural bars. Unless the court has any further questions.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes.
You are. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Boskirk.
Good morning, and thank you for your words earlier. May it please the court, I'm Jonathan Van Boskirk, and I represent the state. Appellant's opening brief raises dozens upon dozens of issues. Raises dozens upon dozens of issues that represent the cumulative work product of 25 years worth of lawyering, almost 25 years. According to appellant, if only trial counsel had spotted all of these issues and acted, we wouldn't be here. The difficulty with that is that trial counsel, Robert Gower, was appointed January 16th, 1991. He confirms January 18th, 1991. Trial goes forward March 4th, 1991. From confirmation to trial, Mr. Gower had exactly 48 days to do everything it's taken them 25 years to say he should have done. Now, Gower was in this situation because on January 23rd, 1991, Guy invokes his right to a speedy trial. The federal public defender argues that Gower could have overruled his client's right to a speedy trial. The only authority they offer for that is at page 89 of their brief. They allege that NRS 174.511 and footnote 21 of Leonard v. State would have allowed trial counsel to overrule his client's decision to go forward with trial in a speedy fashion. The problem with that is they don't say that. NRS 174.511 is the state's speedy trial right. That statute says the state can have trial within 60 days unless defense needs more time. The statute says nothing about overruling a defendant's speedy trial right. The footnote in Leonard is a factual acknowledgement by this court that Leonard personally complained about his speedy trial rights. But if you assume that Leonard actually says what they claim, their argument still fails for three reasons. Number one, it ignores the practical reality of being trial counsel. Robert Gower, backing up a step, it's very easy for those of us who do habeas, successive habeas, to look at the record and say this is how it should be or should have been. But Robert Gower was facing a real human being named Curtis Guy, a man who had already gone through one attorney, who had twice rejected negotiated pleas, who steadfastly believed that he was not guilty because he was not the guy who pulled the trigger, and who wanted to go to trial quickly. Their argument doesn't even acknowledge the need to balance the tension between time to do your job and a cooperative client so you can do your job. The second reason the argument fails, Leonard was a 2001 opinion. This court in NICA has said that, trial counsel is not ineffective for failing to anticipate a change of law. So where Gower stood back in 1991, Guy had the right to a quick trial, and that was up to him. And finally, we know the argument fails because 10 years after Leonard, this court affirmed the denial of the first petition, rejecting claims of ineffective assistance of counsel because Guy invoked his right to a speedy trial. Now, we're not even supposed to talk about Gower until they prove Ms. Erickson was ineffective. Their opening brief offers numerous recycled complaints that this court has rejected in one fashion or another. Where they actually say Ms. Erickson personally dropped the ball in this case, things that she did or didn't do right, if you look at them, they do not establish ineffectiveness. For instance, at the September 2003 evidentiary hearing on the first petition, they argue that Ms. Erickson dropped the ball in responding to the trial court's concern over the testimony of attorney Philip Dunleavy. Dunleavy had inherited a case from Gower, and Erickson wanted to establish a pattern of ineffectiveness. The trial court was concerned that the evidentiary hearing was limited to Gower's conduct in this case. Excuse me. Regardless of what you think of her answer, she was allowed to continue with a line of questioning and make her record. In truth, their ultimate complaint about Ms. Erickson seems to be the view that she's a procrastinator who can't meet a deadline. If that's true, if you assume that is true, there's no ineffectiveness in this case because neither this court nor the trial court rejected any claim of the first petition for delay. And it's worth noting here that in Rimes v. Weber, the United States Supreme Court acknowledged that capital habeas petitioners have an incentive to delay adjudication of their claims. Why? Because they stay alive while we litigate. If that's the standard, Ms. Erickson was incredibly effective. They point out that she entered the case in 1997, and they claim that from 97 to 2001, it fell off her radar and nothing happened. If that's the case, four years of life for Mr. Guy, for nothing. from when she enters in 97 to the notice of appeal in 2007, 10 years of life for her client based on her delays. The point is, delay is not synonymous with ineffectiveness. If you look at their actual complaints, even if you find some deficient performance by Ms. Erickson, they still cannot establish prejudice for the bars or
Let me pause you for just a moment. As you probably gathered from my questions, I'm a bit concerned about what happened with Gower's lack of knowledge of the situation with respect to Pendleton and the charges against Pendleton, who was the actual shooter. This is a felony murder conviction that's supporting a death penalty. And it seems to me, when I look at our opinion in 2011, which resolved the appeal from the first post-conviction, we say on page 24, Guy claimed that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to discover that the charges against Pendleton had been dismissed due to negotiations in another case, and then has additional assertions about Pendleton being willing to testify. And we dismiss it as purely speculative and say Guy presented no evidence at the evidentiary hearing that trial counsel was unaware of what had happened in Pendleton's case, or that Pendleton would have been willing to testify in his behalf. Does that suggest to you that there's some traction on the claim that Gower's failure to investigate Pendleton led to a situation where the jury in Guy's trial convicted Guy and imposed the death sentence not knowing that the charges against Pendleton had been completely dismissed? That's troubling to me. And then the French issue is also treated on page 24, which impacts to me the one more viable aggravator that was left after the other two were eliminated. You had the other one on under penalty of, or sentence of imprisonment. But I would like to address those concerns. I'd like to hear your response to those concerns and why they are or are not properly before us in the context of this second PC.
I would argue that trial counsel was aware to some extent of what was going on in the Pendleton case, because at trial he did in fact try to present Pendleton's admission. I can't tell you whether he knew the charges were dismissed. I know it came up in the direct appeal in the context of an excessiveness argument that the death penalty was excessive based on what happened with Pendleton.
Right, but we said on direct appeal Pendleton was also indicted for Evans' murder. Pursuant to a plea bargain, Pendleton was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. We addressed proportionality, and I realize that's no longer fully viable, but we addressed it and seemed to say we thought Pendleton got life without the possibility of parole for that murder.
The way I read it, and maybe I'm reading it wrong.
And I may be reading it wrong, I don't know.
Is that the court said, number one, excessiveness is irrelevant because the legislature had changed the statute, and under proportionality, you look at this case, this defendant, not other cases. So I saw it as the court saying it's irrelevant.
But what do you do with Edmonds and Tyson then? I mean,
keep those were co-defendants in the same cases.
Yeah.
That's the distinction for me. But taking a step further, the court in the footnote that you note acknowledges the sentence that Pendleton got. That doesn't necessarily, they're saying it was resolved in this fashion. As to which charges were specifically dismissed, I don't know that that matters. It was a global plea negotiation. Have I answered the question or am I missing it?
No, you've answered the question, I think, as well as you can. That's kind of what I was wondering, that's my take on it, but it's of concern. We have a man who was convicted and sentenced to death based today on an aggravator of under sentence of imprisonment, and then the second aggravator is one that I'm not sure, the French one, that plea during his trial or right before this trial in this case is troubling. And then we have a situation where the other guy who was the shooter had all charges against him dismissed, and the court's proportionality review under the statute was taken out, but we nonetheless did look at his status relative to Pendleton's.
I guess what I would add is that there was never a question here that the jury didn't know that Pendleton was the man who pulled the trigger. That was never in contest. The jury was always aware that Pendleton was the actual killer. In terms of what happened to him, what punishment he got, it's not relevant in terms of imposing the death penalty, because we judge death cases based on this defendant, his life, his conduct. And I think that was sort of the thrust of the direct appeal, as well as the 2011 opinion. As to the French aggravator, that was raised on direct appeal, I believe, and the court, and if the court didn't, I know we do in our brief, cite to authority from this court saying that the magic moment is conviction, not when the crime occurs. So
no, I understand that. But they pleaded him right before this trial started, so he had a conviction. They created an additional aggravator by virtue of that plea.
And in the first appeal of the first petition, that issue came up. And my recollection was the court found that there was no indication that had Gower gone to that attorney and said, please undo this, that it would have happened. I think that was the court's concern, that it was something Mr. Gower had no control over because he didn't represent Mr. Guy in that case.
Yeah.
Have I responded to the question? I don't want to answer.
I'm just troubled by it. I'm troubled by a felony murder death conviction with these facts. And I realize it's the second post-conviction and so on. But.
No. To get to the specific claims where they have to establish prejudice for either Mr. Gower or Ms. Erickson, in my mind, they really raise two that aren't mainly recycled. The first of those are their Brady complaints regarding Tyrone White. White was an associate of Pendleton and Guy. He was involved in the Richard French burglary attempt murder case. In his May 2nd, 1990 interview by police, White says, the gun I had during that incident, which is the murder weapon that Pendleton had previously used to kill Evans, first time I see it, Pendleton has it. He testifies to that at trial in the Pendleton case. We skip forward to Guy. Same gun, White testifies. First time I saw it, Guy had it, but I'd seen them both with it. For purposes of Brady, there is no suppression here. This court has repeatedly held that trial counsel has a due diligence obligation to find reasonably available information. I would submit that expecting trial counsel to find the statements of a witness in a co-defendant's trial where his client is charged as well, that's all going on around the same time, is absolutely reasonable. To the extent they say Mr. Gower didn't do it, that goes back to the fact he only had 48 days to do this entire case.
Counsel, let me ask you, when you have a clear conflict between the invocation of the right to speedy counsel, or a speedy trial, and effective assistance of counsel, doesn't counsel have an independent obligation to be competent and effective, even outside of the client's wishes about how fast they want to go? Wasn't it incumbent upon Gower to tell the court, regrettably, I cannot be ready within this time frame?
I think you raise multiple issues there. In the context of the criminal trial, Gower's stuck with the call of his client. I think he can make his record. I think he can complain. But they've given us no authority to say that counsel can overrule his client's constitutional right to a speedy trial.
But you agree counsel has an independent ethical obligation to be effective.
And that may well be the basis of a bar complaint. But they give us no authority to say that any ethical obligation placed on the attorney trumps the client's right to a speedy trial.
But you're saying the right then, the speedy trial right, trumps the right to effective assistance of counsel.
Yeah, push come to shove, absolutely. I think the Constitution beats court rules. And they've given us nothing to say otherwise. And what would have happened, Guy had already lost one attorney. If Gower had said that, he got off the case. What happens to Guy? He gets another attorney who is even
well,
less time.
Gower doesn't have to get off the case. The court can continue it over the objection of Guy. Very easily. That happens all the time. You can say, hey, I understand you want to be speedy. You got counsel here who says they can't be ready in that time frame. And over your objection, noted, I'm gonna continue this until he can be effective.
I think it's usually a little bit more delicately done than that, but I think if push comes to shove, for instance, usually it's a conversation between the court and the client where the court kind of baby steps the client into reality a bit. But if push comes to shove, if the client says, I absolutely want to go to trial in a speedy fashion, they've given us nothing to say that that court rule trumps the Constitution. And to me, it seems the Constitution beats the court rule.
The court rule for?
The ethics rule for the attorney, I'm sorry. I said court rule because they're promulgated by the courts. Have I answered the question?
Yes.
I know you're not happy with the answer, but if I've answered it, I'll move on. As to prejudice for the Brady and false testimony allegation, there is none on this record. Assume Gower had the information. He impeaches with it. What we would have done is argued that any confusion by White, because this isn't a lie, this is prior inconsistent testimony, any confusion by White was justified by the number of guns that flowed through this group and how frequently they changed hands. We would have taken the same May 2nd, 1990 interview they rely on and turned to the part where the police ask White about two guns Pendleton has during the French incident. They ask him, are these Pendleton's guns? Are these the ones he normally carries? At page 2806-07 of volume 14, this is White's answer. Yes, sir, not really. Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, he carried both of them, and then sometimes Justin had them the rest of the time. We would have turned to Guy's April 30th, 1990 confession, where he's asked about the source of a gun that he had. At page 5 of volume 1, Guy says, I can't really say, because we had so many of them, I can't say where I got it from. We would have turned to the same confession, where Guy is asked, where did Pendleton get the gun used to kill Evans? At page 22, volume 1, Guy says, I think I sold him that gun. We also would have turned to the trial testimony of Detective Harry in Guy's trial. Detective Harry told the jury he interviewed Guy May 1st, 1990. In that interview, he asks him, did you personally handle the gun used to kill Evans? At page 886, volume 5, Guy says yes. That transcribed interview is introduced into evidence as State's Trial Exhibit 16. In that interview, Guy is asked, before Pendleton shoots Evans, did you know he had a gun? At page 3870 of volume 19, Guy says yes. Now, although they didn't talk about it, I think it might be worth, well, their second Brady complaint is, it flows from the first. The idea that because there is this inconsistent statement, White must have received a benefit. There's nothing in the record to support that. It is a factual claim where they didn't even make the first hurdle of placing a fact in controversy. Under DCR Rule 13, which incorporates NRCP 56E, it says that in post-trial litigation, you create an issue of fact through an affidavit. Those affidavits are subject to the rules of evidence. The only thing in this record that says White got a benefit is a federal public defender investigator's declaration where he says, I spoke to White and White says. That does not involve personal knowledge and it does not satisfy hearsay. So, and in fact, we brought this to their attention below by making the same argument. And to date, they provided nothing authored by White saying he received a benefit. The second thing they talk about is the idea that Guy's confession is unreliable because he's overly susceptible to suggestion. I would point out that this is utterly belied by the record. Guy has been consistent from day one why he confessed. In his April 30th, 1990 confession, after he's done telling the police everything he did, they ask him, why are you telling us this? And in reference to Pendleton, at page 23 of volume 1, Guy says, so he won't put it all on me. Guy is also prosecuted in the Courtney French case, where he is twice evaluated for competency, and both of those evaluations address his decision to confess. In the June 26, 1990 evaluation by Dr. Masters, Guy says he confessed, quote, because his co-defendant was snitching on him, so he thought he would tell the police the real story. That's at 3631 through 32 of volume 18. In the July 2nd, 1990 evaluation by Dr. Jaworski, the doctor indicates that Guy confessed to counteract statements by Pendleton that Guy was the shooter. That's at 3628 through 29 of volume 18. It's further belied by the fact that Guy twice said no to the suggested negotiation of his case. And in fact, if you go back to his confession in the Jennifer Courtney case, he tells police that he and Pendleton are doing the burglary. Courtney comes home. They restrain her. Guy realizes she can identify us. Pendleton suggests shooting her. Guy says no, the neighbors will hear. Ultimately, this court should affirm for the same reasons it affirmed the judgment of conviction and the denial of the first petition. On direct appeal, this court found that Guy was clearly guilty of felony murder. On appeal from the denial of the first petition, this court found that Guy was sentenced to death because of his extremely violent history and nature. The court noted that Guy shot Richard French in the head at point-blank range. He robbed Colleen Fulkerson by putting a knife to hit her 7-year-old son's throat, and that Guy and Pendleton slit Courtney's throat to avoid her from identifying them. Unless there are other questions, I will cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, contrary to respondent's argument, the U.S. Supreme Court is clear that the right to a speedy trial is not absolute. Under Barker v. Wingo, which counsel had at the time, because under Rule 250, the Supreme Court provided trial counsel with those rules, including a citation to Barker v. Wingo, where the United States Supreme Court has said that the speedy trial is not absolute. And if there is good cause to continue a trial, a court may do so. And in this case, Your Honors, there was good cause to continue the trial. Mr. Gower did not know that Pendleton, the charges against Mr. Pendleton had been dismissed. And we know that because he says that on the record. On May 5th, the second day of the guilt phase, when he is trying to elicit from White Mr. Pendleton's statement as to his culpability, that he was bragging about the crime and getting away with it, the court stopped him because that was hearsay. In trying to elicit the testimony, Mr. Gower explained, well, Pendleton is not available because he has charges against him, which the prosecutor correctly corrected the record and said, no, Your Honor, the charges against Mr. Pendleton have been dropped. So on the record, on the second date of Mr. Guy's trial, capital murder trial, trial counsel is on the record of him not knowing what had happened to Mr. Pendleton's case. And I assume he spoke, Your Honor, Mr. Guy pled to the French incident about a week before trial commenced. Not the day before. And that was not the only incident when trial counsel acknowledges he doesn't know what charges his client is facing. In multiple occasions, when, for example, state witnesses are about to testify, Mr. Gower on the record says, I haven't seen that report. I am not aware of that report. Please give it to me. On the day that the trial began, the prosecutor disclosed the May 1st a statement from Mr. Guy. At that time, trial counsel said, I haven't seen that statement before. So if there were any opportunities for trial counsel to request more time because he needed more time to properly defend his client. That was it. And it's a statement that had not, where in a case where there were no indications of any of evidence for a felony murder rule. So respondent is in trying to speculate as to any strategy that trial counsel may have had, respondent is asking this court to create post hoc rationalizations that this court, that the United States Supreme Court has said no court can do or should not do. Respondent argues that our claims of ineffectiveness are recycled and that we have failed to show prejudice. I would just point the court to Exhibit 235, where post-conviction counsel herself acknowledges the need to obtain the expert testimony of a social historian in order for the court below to understand the mitigation evidence her, albeit not complete investigation had unearthed. She approaches the social historian a month after the evidentiary hearing had already been postponed once. A month before the hearing, she's asking for the social historian expert to please help her explain the mitigation. The social historian is not available. Exactly the prejudice that she articulates in that email is what the court below found. This court in Kennedy cited Doe v. Ayers, where such an expert like the one who Ms. Erickson tried to engage, actually testified, exactly as to the sexual abuse that defendant had suffered. We also show prejudice because although she sought and obtained funding for a neuropsychologist, she presented no evidence of Mr. Guy's frontal lobe impairment, which affects his cognitive ability and his ability to foresee the consequences of his actions. Neither the jury nor this court before knew that Mr. Guy had frontal lobe damage. Respondent also argues that we failed to show materiality for the NAPUI and the Brady violations because Mr. Guy's statement he submits that he once upon a time had the gun in his hand. And the respondent argues that that is no problem, they would have made their cases anyway. But that's not what the U.S. Supreme Court says the test as to a false testimony claim is. The test is whether there is any reasonable likelihood. And unlike Brady, where it says any reasonable probability, NAPUI's test is any reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the jury. And we know here that it could have affected the jury because in closing, the prosecutor says, defendant argues that he's not an aider and abettor. We know he is. We ask you to use your common sense. We know he is because White tells you it was his gun. And he says, you know, Guy tells you it was his gun based on the May 1st statement. But that is the same statement that a justice court found not enough of to give probable cause for both the robbery as well as the murder in that incident. If the court has any other questions.
All right, thank you, counsel. All right, the court will stand in recess.